I've always loved him, Pamela said, and I think I've always known what he was like. It was part of the attraction that he was a daredevil and afraid of nothing. I'll get over it, I suppose. It will take a while, but... Trixie nodded. There are plenty more fish in the sea. I got friendly with a rather delicious RAF chap last night, and we'll have fun this Saturday at your mother's garden party, won't we? Pamela sank down beside Trixie. Gosh, Trixie, I don't even want to go home now. How can I face Dido? How can I stand being in the same house with her? It's a big house, and there will be lots of people. Why don't we both dress up as maids and hand around the eats? Wouldn't that be a lark? I don't feel like larks at the moment. In fact, I think I'll send a telegram to my mother saying that I can't get time off after all. Oh, don't do that, Trixie said. I can't go down there on my own, and I'm really looking forward to it. How long since we've enjoyed life as it used to be? Tea on the lawn, flowery dresses and hats. It all seems like a lovely dream now, doesn't it? Yes, Pamela said. Yes, it does. She sighed. Oh, well, I suppose I must go. Livy's not much help at organizing things, and my mother will be in a tizzy. Jolly good, Trixie said. She stood up again. Now, I'd better get dressed and stagger to work. It's lucky I'm not breaking codes, or I'd say that enemy aircraft were sighted in Bombay instead of Birmingham. Pamela tried to smile as Trixie went to the bathroom. Chapter 35 To Farley. Ben wasn't quite sure what he should be doing that day. He had delivered Pamela's radio messages to Dolphin Square with the suggestion that they might be matched to known meetings of ring members. He had been to chivvy up Mavis to find the location on the photograph. So what now? Guy had hinted that he'd be sent to shadow Margot Sutton, but those instructions would have to come from Maxwell Knight. Ben felt uneasy and superfluous, but he also didn't feel like going to Dolphin Square and saying, "Please, sir, what should I do now?" like one of the fourth formers he'd been teaching until he was called up. Initiative. That was what was required by MI5. He had wanted to be given challenges, to be noticed, and now he was at the heart of a major plot. He turned on the radio and was glad to find that the royal family had been unharmed in last night's bombing. He twiddled the dial between frequencies, hoping to pick up the German channel, but gave up after a while. Guy was off on a mission somewhere. Ben wondered what he did and how long he'd been working secretly for Knight. Then he paused, thinking. Guy seemed to know all about the ring. He knew that Margot Sutton had been rescued. That meant he was part of an inner circle. Or, Ben paused. Guy fitted the profile of someone who would be part of the ring. Aristocratic family, the sort at Oxford who took risks, liked his comforts. Had he told Ben about Margot Sutton to throw any suspicion from himself? Ben wondered how he could find out. But then Maxwell Knight trusted him, and Ben was sure that Knight was a superb judge of character. Or perhaps Knight knew that he was a double agent and was using him. Ben would have liked to ask Knight, but realized he had absolutely no proof that Guy wasn't exactly what he seemed. And he remembered what Guy had said about the so-called Captain King. He answers to nobody but Churchill, a man who could be dangerous and powerful. And it crossed his mind that Maxwell Knight himself might be just the sort of person to run a secret organization like the Ring. Again, he found himself asking if he had been put on the job with the expectation that they were keeping Whitehall happy, but that he would get it wrong. He wondered if he should go and see Mavis, but that seemed rather pathetic on a personal level and rather annoying on a professional one. He wondered if the photograph even mattered any longer. If the parachutists had come to deliver an important message, then surely the Germans had already sent the message by another means. He went to the British Library and read up more on those battles, but found nothing that he didn't already know. A king had been deposed by a stronger rival. Many men had been killed. But it had eventually brought peace. He could see parallels, but couldn't work out what they might mean. He returned home and cheered up when he remembered he had promised to go down to Kent with Pamela the next day. Margot Sutton stared out the window of the Daimler as she was driven out of London. City gave way to suburb, and then to green and rolling countryside. It felt too good to be true that she was actually back in England, that she was going home to her family, and the ordeal was over. She tried to feel happy and excited, but instead all she could feel was hollow and empty inside, as if part of her had died when they had taken her to that cell at Gestapo headquarters. The past days had been like living a nightmare, and she had steeled herself to accept that it would end in her death, or at the very least in being sent to a German prison camp. Her fingernail had already healed. She bore no visible scars of her ordeal. The scar in her heart would take longer to go away. Gaston had denied ever loving her. He had shown complete disdain for her and for the pain being inflicted on her. She watched green hedgerows flash past. "I was a complete fool," she thought. "I gave up everything, risked everything, for a man who didn't even love me." Memory swelled back into her consciousness. Gaston strolling with her through the Bois de Boulogne, sitting opposite her at a little café, his eyes glowing with desire as he looked into hers. He had loved her. Of this she was suddenly sure. Then she toyed with what Gigi Armand had said, that Gaston had shown disdain for her only to protect her. At the time she hadn't believed it, but now she realized it might have been true. His words to the German had been his way of saving her. By giving the impression that she meant nothing to him, he had spared her from further torture. If Gaston was perceived to be completely indifferent to her suffering, then there would be little point in continuing it. "He saved me," she whispered to herself. "He did love me. He loved me enough to die for me." And she also came to terms with the realization that nothing she had done could have saved him. He would never have betrayed his fellow resistance members, and the Germans would never have released him. "True to the end," she whispered, and felt a small glow of consolation inside the blackness of her grief. And now she was free to resume her former life. Free. Not quite free, she knew that. But she would tackle the next hurdle when she came to it. For now, she was going to try to enjoy the Kentish countryside and her family. They drove through Sevenoaks, then their surroundings became familiar. She had ridden over these fields with the Hunt when she was a girl. "It's strange," she thought, "but I feel like an old woman, as if my life has already happened." And she wondered if she would ever feel normal again. And then, of course, the worries crept back into her head. Would she dare to go through with it? How could she be brave enough to make Gaston proud of her? Then they were driving through Elmsley. There was the village green with the cricket scoreboard still showing the numbers of the last game. The church beyond. Miss Hamilton walking her dogs. Nothing had changed at all. "Only me," Margot thought. Phoebe was in her schoolroom, reciting the Order of English Kings and Queens to her governess. She had got as far as Richard III and was stuck. She paced around the room. "Richard III," she said again, and then, "Battle of Bosworth," Miss Gumbel reminded her. "What happened after that?" "And then," Phoebe looked out the window and gave a shriek of delight. "It's Margot," she shouted. "Margot's home!" She rushed down the hall, down the two flights of stairs, shouting the good news. Lord Westerham was in the morning room, reading the newspaper. He put it down and glared at his daughter. What have I told you about that screaming and shouting? Doesn't your governess tell you that a lady never raises her voice?
But Pa, Phoebe said, her face still alight with joy. It's Margot. She's home.
Around midday on Friday, Ben was getting ready to go to Victoria when Guy tapped on his door.
Listen, old chap, I have it on good authority that Margot Sutton is being driven home to Kent. I wondered if you could find a good excuse to be down there.
As a matter of fact, I'm heading there right now, Ben said. Pamela Sutton asked me to help with the garden party her mother is giving tomorrow. A smile crossed Guy's face.
A garden party? Are there still such things? Remarkable. I might hop on a train and join you. Strawberries and cream on the lawn? So definitely pre-war. What's it in aid of? Fundraising for our troops?
Ben shrugged.
I've no idea. All I know is that Lady Westrom was in a panic about holding a garden party when she didn't have the staff or the supplies, and Pamela agreed to go and help.
So you'll put on tails and pretend to be the butler, will you?
Guy chuckled.
Actually, they still have their butler. He's too old to be called up. But no footman and only a couple of maids.
How the upper classes are made to suffer, Guy said with heavy sarcasm. Mummy wrote that she had to clean her own lavatory the other day. Imagine!
Ben smiled. He realized what a shock wartime living must be for so many of Guy's class. He was about to leave when he heard footsteps coming up the stairs and was startled to see a dispatch rider heading toward him. The man stopped and saluted.
Mr. Cresswell, I was told to deliver this to you immediately. It comes from Medmenham.
Thank you, Ben stammered. The man saluted and stomped back down the stairs. Ben went into his room, closed the door, and opened the envelope.
I think I've located the place on your photograph, Mavis had written. It's marked on the Ordnance Survey map. Actually, in Somerset, not Devon or Cornwall as you had thought.
Ben's heart was thumping. He had to tell someone before he met Pamela at the station. He grabbed his overnight bag, then took the underground and walked as fast as he could to Dolphin Square. He rang the doorbell down below, but there was no answer. He rode up in the elevator and tapped on the door. Again, no answer. An elderly man was coming down the hall toward him.
No use knocking, he said. They went away. I saw them with suitcases earlier this morning.
Damn, Ben muttered to himself. He took the lift back down and stood in bright sunshine, trying to think what to do next. There was nobody he could tell about the photograph. Guy had gone out, and Ben had no idea when he'd return. Besides, he had an uneasy feeling about Guy. He'd have to go to Somerset himself, but Pamela was waiting for him at the station. He sighed and headed to Victoria. Pamela and Trixie were waiting under the destination board. Pamela waved when she spotted him.
You made it! How lovely!
Hello, Ben, Trixie said. I'm so pleased to see you're coming, too. I'm all set to be a maid. I wanted to rent one of those frilly French maid's outfits in a costumes shop, but Pamma wouldn't let me.
As if my family ever had a frilly French maid, Pamma said, giving Ben an exasperated look.
Even Ma's never had a French lady's maid. Hers is middle-aged and stodgy and called Philpot.
Then your family needs livening up, Trixie said. Mummy always had French maids, and Daddy always chased them. It kept their marriage happy.
Pamela pretended to be studying the departure board.
So there is a train in half an hour on Platform 11. That's good. Plenty of time to buy our tickets and get over there.
Look, Pamma, Ben cleared his throat. I'm not sure what to do. I have to go down to Somerset right away, something I absolutely have to check on. So I should really head to Paddington and take the first train down there. But I did promise I'd come with you to help your ma, so I hope you understand if I back out on you.
Of course, Pamma said. It doesn't matter, I'm sure.
You have to do your job.
What's so important in Somerset? Trixie asked.
Nothing ever happens there except for making cider and cheese. She laughed, but then she studied Ben's face.
You really are involved in secrets and intrigue, aren't you? I thought you had to be when I saw you at Bletchley.
I know. Let me come down to Somerset with you. I'm a Bletchley girl. I've signed the Official Secrets Act. I won't say a word, and I'm dying for excitement.
It's not going to be exciting, Ben said. I just have to check on a map reference.
And you are certainly not going with Ben, Pamela said, giving Trixie a cold look. If anyone goes with him, it will be me.
You both have to help Lady Westerham, Ben said.
But how are you going to get around when you're there? Pamela asked.
Train? Bus? My feet?
They have buses once a week in places like Somerset.
I'll manage.
I have a good idea, Pamela said. Come down to Kent with us, and we'll ask to borrow Pa's rolls. I'll drive you.
But what about your mother?
If we went straight away this afternoon, we could be back in good time before the party. Do you think it will take long, what you have to do there?
I've no idea, Ben said. Frankly, I'm not sure what I'm looking for.
That sounds like a lark, Trixie said. I still think that Pamma should stay with her mama and you should take me with you, Ben.
I don't think I should take anybody with me, Ben said uneasily.
Yes, you will, Pamela said. You'll need someone to map-read while you drive. Or better still, I'll drive and you read the map. That will make it go so much faster.
I suppose so, he agreed.
So you want me to stay and slave away in your place? Trixie said with a mock pout.
Pamela gave Trixie a grateful glance. Would you really? I suppose so, if I have to. Slaving at garden parties for Britain, I may get a medal.
Pamela laughed.
You are a brick.
That's me, Trixie the Brick, she said.
Come on, we have to buy those tickets and there is a long line.
Ben pulled Pamela aside. Do you think your father would let us have the rolls? Ben asked, still torn between catching the next train from Paddington and having Pamela beside him in a motor car.
If not, we'll ask the Prescotts. They have extra motor cars, Pamela said breezily. And plenty of petrol by the look of it.
Do you think they'd really lend me a car? Ben asked.
They'd lend me one, Pamela said calmly. They still think...
So it really is over between you and Jeremy.
How could it possibly not be? She said. But never mind that now. We have a job to do.
It's really good of you, Pamela, he said.
Not at all. It will be an adventure, and I need something to cheer me up.
When they arrived home, they were greeted by an ecstatic Phoebe, announcing once again that Margot had returned. This necessitated hugs and tears and ended up in having tea with the family.
"Just like old times," as Lady Westerham put it. "My greatest prayer has been answered, and my girls are all with us again."
Margot looked drawn and pale and gave a sad sort of smile. Ben debated whether he should stay, now that Margot was here, or go chasing the photograph. The latter won. Margot announced that she was really tired and would they excuse her if she went up to her room. As they had feared, Lord Westerham did object to their taking the rolls.
"I'm not allowing you two off on some joyride, using up the last of my petrol ration," he bellowed.
"But, Pa, it's important," Pamela said. "Something that Ben has to do for his job, and I said I'd go along to help him."
"If it's important for his job, then the government can supply him with a vehicle. They get petrol. I don't," he snapped.
"I'm awfully sorry," Pamela whispered. "I didn't think he'd be such an old meanie. It's too bad we can't tell him why we need the car. He doesn't realize it's a matter of national security. But he's right. Couldn't your boss requisition a vehicle for you?"
"It seems he's away for the weekend," Ben said. "And I just don't feel that this can wait."
"What is this all about?"
Pamela asked in a low voice. Ben thought there was no point in keeping quiet now that she knew he was MI5.
"That parachutist who fell into your field," he said, drawing her aside where they couldn't be overheard. "He had nothing on him at all. No identification, only a photograph with numbers on it. And someone has finally found the location where it was taken, so I have to go there right away."
"We can't tell the Prescotts that," Pamela said. She looked out the window.
"I say, there are loads of army vehicles sitting idle outside our house. Do you think we dare borrow one?"
"And be shot as we leave with it." Ben had to laugh. Then he thought and said,
"But I could ask Colonel Pritchard. He seemed like a decent sort of chap. He knows all about the parachutist, and I could tell him who I'm working for."
"Then do it," Pamela said. "I'll go and change into something more suitable for driving, and I'll pack my toothbrush, just in case we're stuck for the night." She grinned at him.
"I never thought I'd smile again, but this is going to be fun."
Chapter 36 To Somerset. Colonel Pritchard listened with interest, but was hesitant.
"I can't give you my staff car. Apart from that, I've only lorries, tanks, and armoured cars here. You'd certainly be conspicuous driving around in one of those, and I doubt you even have the correct license."
He paused, then said,
"I tell you what, have you ridden a motorbike?"
"A couple of times, when I was up at Oxford," Ben said.
"Then you can take my dispatcher's motorbike and sidecar. It doesn't use much petrol either."
So half an hour later, they set off with Pamela in the sidecar and Ben sitting rather uneasily on the motorbike. Pamela had changed into slacks and an open-necked shirt. Her hair was tied back under a scarf. Ben had to concentrate fully on driving the unfamiliar machine and was hardly conscious that he had a passenger and the passenger was Pamma. It wasn't a powerful machine, and Ben soon settled down. Driving would have been pleasant on roads that were almost deserted, thanks to petrol rationing, except that all signposts had been removed and they took a couple of wrong turns before they reached the main road to the southwest. Then they breezed along at a good rate, encountering only the occasional army lorry or delivery van. It was close to 9 in the evening by the time they had passed through Wiltshire and driven into Somerset. Darkness threatened to come upon them suddenly. The setting sun had been swallowed into an ominous bank of clouds. A chill wind had sprung up. Ben turned to Pamela with a worried look on his face.
"Golly, we didn't think about rain, did we? I now see that a motorbike has distinct limitations."
"Then let's hurry and get the job done," Pamela said.
"How close do you think we are?"
Ben studied the map.
"Quite close. That last village must have been Hinton St. George. That means the hill should be ahead on our left soon. We've seen plenty of hills, but this one has a distinctive shape."
He held up the copy of the photograph for her to study.
"And see the church tower and those three big pines. They should be easy enough to identify."
Pamela nodded.
"Then lead on, Macduff."
The lane took them through the Somerset levels, where cows grazed in fields separated by water channels. It seemed to Ben that they had left the hilly part of the region behind, and he wondered if his map-reading skills had led him astray. Then they passed through a village of thatched cottages, and Pamela pointed.
"Look! That's it!"
As they came closer, they could see the church rising above those pine trees. They looked at each other and smiled. It took them a while to find a road that led them to the top of the hill, but in the dying light of day, they drove up to the church, and Ben stopped the bike. Rooks were cawing loudly from the trees in the churchyard where old gravestones lay at drunken angles. The wind from the west hit them in the face as they walked forward. The church was called All Saints. Ben looked around and saw a small house behind the churchyard. Apart from that, there were no dwellings in sight. The place had a gloomy and forsaken feel to it.
"Now what?" Pamela asked.
Now what indeed? They had passed a couple of small cottages as the road wound up the hill, but there was no sign of a village or the substantial manor house Ben had hoped for.
"I suppose we should visit the vicarage before we go down," Ben said.
"Are you expecting to find a hotbed of Nazi sympathizers there?" Pamela asked, half-joking.
"Are you armed, just in case?"
She saw the look on his face and burst out laughing.
"I think we've been had," she said.
"I think there was a hidden message in the photograph, and the actual place was irrelevant."
"I'm afraid I have to agree," Ben said.
But he found a mossy path through the churchyard and knocked on the vicarage door. It was opened by an elderly cleric with wispy white hair and an angelic face. Ben said that they were driving around the West Country and interested in old churches, particularly remote old churches. They were invited in and served elderberry wine made by a parishioner, the vicar told them.
"But where is your parish?" Pamela asked. "We didn't see any houses."
"Ah, well," the vicar said, "there is indeed a history to this church. It was once a part of a monastery, taken over at the time of Henry VIII, and handed to a local lord who turned the monastery into his manor. Then, during the Civil War, it was razed to the ground by Oliver Cromwell. But the church survived and has served the neighbouring farms and villages ever since."
"So the manor house is no more?"
"Part of the ruined walls still stand, but that's about it."
"So does anyone else live around here these days?" Pamela asked.
"Nobody for a good half mile," the vicar said.
"It must be lovely for you."
He nodded.
"My wife died 3 years ago. A woman comes in to clean once a week. I do my rounds on my bicycle, but yes, it is pretty remote. Luckily, I have my books and the wireless." He stood up. "It will be dark soon, but would you like to see the church?"
"Thank you." Ben and Pamela rose to follow. He took a torch from the hall table and shone their way between the gravestones. Inside the church, the last of the daylight came in through tall, perpendicular windows, giving an impression of a long nave with pillars on either side. The church smelled old and damp and was clearly in a state of disrepair. The vicar walked them around, shining his torch on marble slabs marking tombs of dead knights. Then he said,
"If you'd like to go up the tower, we've a wonderful view from the top. I won't come with you. The old legs can't take the stairs any more, you understand. There is a light on the stair, but we shouldn't use it because of the blackout. Here, take my torch."
He showed them a door in the wall. Beyond it, a stone spiral stair led up and up. The torch, covered in blackout fabric, picked out one step after another, but it was still eerie and horribly cold. At last they came to a little door, unlatched it, and stepped out onto the platform at the top of the tower. A ray of dying sun had pierced the clouds and painted the channels of water below pink. In the distance, they could make out the open water of the Bristol Channel.
"This would be a good place to signal from," Ben said.
Pamela nodded.
"But who would be doing the signalling?" she replied.
The wind now carried the first hints of rain.
"We should get going," Ben said.
The vicar walked with them back to the motorbike and waved as they left. It was starting to rain hard now, a stinging wind-blown rain from the sea.
"So do you think we should come back again in daylight and find out who might be living nearby?" Pamela asked.
"I wonder what we'd achieve with that," Ben said, looking around at the dark woods.
"The vicar would have mentioned anyone strange or suspicious, wouldn't he? He said his parish was only neighbouring farms and cottages. Presumably country people who have farmed here for generations. We could examine the ruins of the old monastery in daylight, but again, wouldn't the vicar have noticed anything suspicious going on?"
Frankly, I'm not hopeful myself. I think you were right in what you said before. That it's a hidden message, not an actual place.
I suppose, Pamela nodded.
So we'll go back to London, and you can report what you found, and my mother will kill me if we don't get back for her party.
We should stop for something to eat first, Ben said. I don't know about you, but I'm starving.
Good luck at this time of night, Pamela chuckled. I bet they all go to bed by 8 in the country, especially now that the blackout makes travel so hard.
And I think you'll find it really difficult to drive home in the dark, Ben. Maybe it would be more sensible to find somewhere for the night and leave at first light tomorrow.
Did you bring overnight clothes? She laughed.
A toothbrush, but I'll survive.
It had been raining as they wound their way down the hill, but the overhead canopy of trees protected them. As they came out onto the flatlands, the heavens opened into a downpour.
"We can't go on in this, Ben!"
Pamela shouted over the drumming of the rain. Thunder grumbled in the distance.
"There was a pub in that first village!" Ben shouted back.
They crept along at a snail's pace, conscious of the water-filled ditches now overflowing on either side of the road. Then the first houses appeared, and they could make out a pub sign. It was called the Fox and Hounds, and had a thatched roof and a nice old-world feel to it. Ben parked the bike under an overhang in the courtyard, and they sprinted to the front door. When they came in, they were greeted by a low murmur of voices and saw several older men standing around the bar. A couple of dogs lay at their heels. The room had a beamed ceiling and an enormous fireplace. All eyes were on them as they approached the bar.
"Been for a swim, have you, then?" the landlord asked in a strong Somerset accent. "My word, but you look like a couple of drowned rats," he chuckled.
"We were on a motorbike," Ben said. "Would you possibly have rooms for the night?"
"I've just got the one room," the landlord said. "I don't suppose you'll mind that, will you?"
Ben looked at Pamela. Before he could say anything, she gave a bright smile.
"Of course not. That would be lovely."
"I'll see if the missus can send up an airing rack to dry your clothes," the landlord went on. "Should I bring up a couple of pints of beer or cider?"
Ben looked at Pamela, and she said,
"Cider for me, please. And something to eat?"
The landlord frowned.
"We don't serve food any more, not since rationing. But the wife has baked pasties, and I dare say we can spare a couple."
He led them up a creaky staircase to the room. It had an enormous double bed, piled high with quilts. As soon as the landlord closed the door, Pamela looked at it and laughed.
"Talk about the princess and the pea!
And you, being of noble birth, will undoubtedly be too uncomfortable to sleep," Ben tried to sound light-hearted.
"On the contrary, after all that fresh air, I shall sleep perfectly," she said.
"We should take off our wet clothes," Ben said. "Do you want me to wait outside while you change?"
His face was red with embarrassment.
"I'm not too badly soaked," Pamela said.
"My legs were under the canopy of the sidecar, and my blouse was only wet around the collar. My jacket, however, is a disaster." She took it off and draped it over the back of a chair.
"You, on the other hand," she looked at him and laughed.
"Quite damp, I'd say."
He laughed too.
"Go on, take them off."
"I won't look," she said.
Ben stripped to his underwear and wrapped himself in a towel that was hanging on the rack.
"You take the bed. I'll curl up in that chair," he said, not looking at her.
"You certainly won't. There is room for both of us," she said. "You need a good night's sleep as much as I do."
There was a tap at the door, and a landlady appeared with glasses of cider and two pasties.
"Give me the wet things, and I'll put them in the airing cupboard," she said,
and then gave them a bright smile and left. The cider and pasties went down remarkably well. Then Pamela climbed up into the bed, and Ben turned the light out before sliding in beside her.
"Are you sure this is all right?"
he asked.
Pamela put a hand on his arm. "Oh, Ben, you are so sweet. I feel perfectly safe with you. You're like the brother I never had."
"Good," Ben said. He didn't mean it. They lay there in darkness, listening to the drumming of rain and the distant growl of thunder.
"I never felt safe with Jeremy," Pamela said suddenly. "I suppose that was part of the attraction, that he was not quite safe. Flirting with danger, you know. He wanted to make love to me, but I wouldn't let him."
There was silence again, then she blurted out,
"I was wondering, do you think I might be frigid?"
"I hope you're not suggesting that I prove otherwise right now," Ben said with an uneasy laugh. She laughed too.
"Oh, no, of course not. It's just that I've been wondering ever since, and feeling guilty. If I'd given Jeremy what he wanted, he'd never have seduced Dido."
"I don't think Dido needed much seducing," Ben said. "You, on the other hand, would want everything to be right before you committed yourself. That's the way you are."
"You understand me so well," she said,
and she laid her head on his shoulder. He could hear his heart beating, horribly conscious of her nearness, the cool touch of her skin. "The brother she never had," he muttered to himself. She fell asleep quickly, and he lay listening to her breathing. They woke to a deafening chorus of birds and sounds of activity outside. A farmer was driving cows past the window. A tractor was heading for the field. They looked at each other and smiled. "A little rumpled, but hardly the worse for wear," Pamela said. "You look splendid," Ben said. "Would you go down and find my clothes? Then we'll get some breakfast and be off, shall we?" Down in the private bar, the landlady cooked them bacon, eggs, fried bread.
"That was wonderful," Pamela said. "After what we've been living on, my landlady is a horrible cook."
"You're out on a little holiday, then, are you, before your young man goes back into uniform?"
"That's right," Pamela said. "And we were interested in that hill over there. Does it have any sort of special history?"
"What, Church Hill, you mean?" the landlady asked. "Is that its name?" Ben asked sharply. "That's how it's always been known around here."
"What is it, Ben?" Pamela asked while the landlady cleared away their plates. "You've gone quite white."
"I was just looking at the calendar on the wall," he said. "It's the 14th of June. That makes the date 14/6/1941. Look at the numbers on the photograph. 1461. Today's date. I think I know what it must mean now. This was an order from Germany to kill Churchill today."
Chapter 37. In Somerset.
"We must let somebody know right away." Ben jumped up and headed for the door. "But who? My boss is away. 10 Downing Street. They'll know where Mr. Churchill is. They can take precautions."
His heart was hammering, and he could hear himself babbling as he ran to catch up with the landlady.
"Do you have a telephone?"
"There is a telephone box in the middle of the village outside the post office," she said.
"I'll collect our things. You go," Pamela called.
He ran down the street and stood in the telephone box, fumbling for coins. Did he have the right change? Surely the operator would connect him in a national emergency.
"Number, please," came the operator's voice.
"I need you to connect me with 10 Downing Street," Ben said, trying to sound calm. "This is an emergency."
"Are you being funny?" she asked.
"No, of course I am not being funny," he snapped. "I am with MI5, and I'm stuck in the depths of Somerset, and it is imperative that I speak with someone immediately."
He was surprised at his own forcefulness.
"Very good, sir. I'll do what I can."
The woman sounded shaken. Ben waited impatiently. Then a male voice came on the line.
Prime Minister's residence? How can I help you?
Is the Prime Minister there? Ben asked.
No, sir. I believe he spent the night in the war rooms, the calm voice said.
Then please listen carefully, Ben said. My name is Benjamin Cresswell. I am an agent of MI5. My superiors will vouch for that, if necessary. But I have reason to believe there is a plot to assassinate the Prime Minister today.
Sir, we get threats against the Prime Minister all the time, said the patient voice.
Can you substantiate this? And why has this information not gone through the proper channels?
Because my boss is away this weekend, and I can't reach him. I have been following a lead that started with a dead German, and I'm standing in the middle of the bloody Somerset countryside, and I thought you might like to know, Ben heard himself shouting.
Can you give me details?
Obviously not over a public phone line where any number of people may be listening in, Ben said. But I suggest he stays put in the war rooms today.
The Prime Minister is scheduled to attend a ceremony at Biggin Hill Aerodrome, the voice said.
I'm sure he will not change his plans because of an unsubstantiated threat.
And he will be at an aerodrome. Where could he be better protected?
I've done my part, Ben said as frustration boiled over. I have warned you. If you choose to disregard my warning, upon your head be it.
Look, I'll advise the Prime Minister's security detail to be armed and extra vigilant, the voice said. But if you think the PM would ever stay home like a frightened rabbit because of a threat against his life, then you don't know Churchill.
Ben put the receiver down and walked back to Pamela.
Have they told the Prime Minister? Will they take steps? She asked him.
I'm not sure, Ben sighed. I don't know what else to do.
She touched his arm.
You've done your part. You were the one who worked out the plot against him.
But all of that is no use if he gets shot anyway, is it? Bloody fools! So damned complacent! What else can I do?
Telephone Biggin Hill, I suppose, and go there ourselves as quickly as possible. With any luck, we'll get there before it's too late.
Phoebe awoke early, feeling excited and restless. It wasn't just the garden party and her mother's anxiety that all would go smoothly. Something else was going on. Why had Ben and Pamela left in a hurry on a motorbike right when Margot came home? She felt sorry for Pamela's friend, brought here and then abandoned while they went off without her. And then there was the telephone call she had overheard the night before. Someone in Pa's study making a phone call late at night. A woman's voice, but Phoebe couldn't hear what was being said through the thick wood of the door. Then Soames had come past, and she'd had to go up to bed. A morning ride, that's what she needed. She put on her jodhpurs and riding boots, grabbed her crash cap, and went down to the stables. Old Jackson was already up and about. Phoebe paused and stared up at Miss Gumbel's window. Was she already awake? Would she report that Phoebe had gone out riding without permission?
"Saddle up Snowball, please, Jackson," Phoebe said.
"Is the master all right with you taking her out alone?" he asked.
"I'll be good and not gallop and not jump over logs," she said. "But she hasn't been exercised enough lately, and she's getting fat."
"That's true enough," he agreed. "Do you want me to come with you?"
"No, you'll make me walk too slowly," she said.
He grinned. "Well, I don't suppose any harm will come to you. You're a grand little rider, I'll say that for you. A credit to your family."
Phoebe beamed and glanced up at Miss Gumbel's window again.
"You don't need to worry about her," Jackson said. "She went out hours ago, off on one of them bird-watching expeditions with her binoculars round her neck."
Phoebe mounted her pony, and they set off. Once out of sight of the house, she urged Snowball into a canter, enjoying the feel of the early morning breeze in her face.
She hoped she might meet Alfie in the fields, but there was no sign of him. She directed Snowball closer to the woods and the gamekeeper's lodge, but again saw nothing. She was on a bridle path through a stand of trees when she heard the sound of a motor vehicle driving up the track beyond a thick stand of rhododendron bushes. It didn't sound like a big army lorry, and she tried to get a glimpse of it, but the shrubbery was too thick. She heard the motor stop, then she heard a voice.
"You got my message, then?"
It was low, hardly more than a whisper, but clearly a woman's.
"What's wrong?"
This time a man's voice.
"I can't go through with it."
"You have to. It's all planned. You can't back out now."
"But I can't do it."
"You have to. Obviously, I can't do it now, so it's up to you. You agreed."
"Please don't make me do this."
"You know the consequences if you don't see it through."
Phoebe thought she heard a sob. The voice dropped to a mutter. Phoebe wanted to urge the horse forward, but was scared that the chinking of the bit would give her away. Then she heard clearly,
"Here's the gun, already loaded. Take it. Don't let us down."
Then a car door shut, and she heard the sound of an engine reversing. She looked for a way through the bushes, but the undergrowth was too thick to take a pony through. By the time she had found a way around, the track was deserted, and only tire marks indicated that the scene had just happened. Phoebe's heart was racing. She had enjoyed her sleuthing and spy-catching with Alfie, but that had been more of a game than anything. Now a loaded gun had been passed from one person to another, and that person was frightened. Who were they, and what were they doing meeting at Farley? She needed to tell somebody. If she went to Pa, he probably wouldn't believe her. Ma wouldn't be interested. She could have told Pama, but she was away, and Miss Gumble was out bird-watching for the day. What did it say on that poster with the seven rules on it? Report anything suspicious to the authorities. That likely meant the village constable. She didn't think he was very bright, but he could at least pass the information along to the right people. She had to find Alfie and tell him. He'd believe her. She rode back to the gamekeeper's lodge, dismounted, and tied Snowball's bridle to a tree branch. Mrs. Robbins looked uneasy and embarrassed as she opened the door.
"Oh, your ladyship! Is something the matter? Mr. Robbins was having a bit of a lie-in this morning. He's still in his night clothes, and we're not really ready to receive visitors."
"I'm sorry, but is Alfie awake? I'd like a word with him," Phoebe said.
"He's in the kitchen having his breakfast. I'll go and get him for you," she said.
Phoebe waited, and soon Alfie appeared, wiping his mouth.
"Smashing porridge she makes. She's a good cook, all right," he grinned.
"What's up?"
"You look worried."
"I am worried," Phoebe said. "I don't quite know what to do. I was out riding, and I heard a car driving up that old track behind the rhododendrons, and then I heard voices. One was a woman, and she was frightened, and the man said she had to do something and gave her a loaded gun."
"Blimey," Alfie said.
"Who was it?" "That's the problem. I was on Snowball, and the bushes are so thick there. By the time I found a way around, they'd both gone. So what do you think we should do?"
"Tell your dad, of course."
"I suppose so, but he'd think I misheard or was making it up. I was wondering whether we should go to Constable Jarvis."
"Him? He's as thick as a plank."
Alfie looked scornful.
"But he is the authorities, isn't he? My father probably wouldn't believe me, and my mother wouldn't listen, and Pamela's away."
Alfie nodded.
"All right, we'll go and see Constable Jarvis. But let me finish my breakfast first."
"Alfie, this is urgent," Phoebe said. "Get dressed. I'll take Snowball back to the stables and meet you down here in half an hour."
She urged Snowball into a reluctant canter all the way back, swung herself down, and handed over the pony to the groom.
"Is Miss Bumble back yet?"
she asked.
"I ain't seen hide nor hair of her, your ladyship," the groom said.
"Oh!"
The thought had just come to Phoebe that Miss Gumble would be the right person to tell. She would take Phoebe seriously and know the right thing to do. But as she walked up the steps into the house, another horrifying thought struck her.
Ben Cresswell had been suspicious about Miss Gumble, hadn't he? He'd asked about her telescope and her papers, and Ben was a level-headed sort of chap, and he and Pamela had gone off somewhere in a hurry. That meant something was going on. Phoebe revised her plan. Maybe she should go down to the vicarage and see if he had come back. If not, she'd write a note for him. He and Pamela would have to be back before the garden party at the very least. If anyone knew what to do, it would be Ben. No family member was inside as she went into the dining room and grabbed a hasty slice of toast, spreading marmalade on it and gulping it down. She wanted to pour herself a cup of tea, but she knew that if Pa came in, she'd be in trouble for coming to breakfast in riding gear. She looked up when she heard footsteps, but it was only Pamma's friend Trixie who had come to help with the party. She looked pretty and elegant in a summery dress, and she smiled when she saw Phoebe.
"Hello, young lady," she said.
"Going out riding? Lovely day for it. If I hadn't signed up for hard labour today, I'd come and join you."
"Actually, I just got back," Phoebe said.
"I'm going down to the village with Alfie. Would you tell the others when you see them?"
"Of course,"
Trixie said.
"Who was Alfie? Your boyfriend?"
She gave Phoebe a teasing smile. Phoebe blushed.
"Of course not. He's the gamekeeper's boy. But we are friends, and we've an important job to do. Something I overheard that needs to be reported."
"Good for you," Trixie nodded and smiled.
"Only don't stay away too long, or your mother will not be pleased. It's all hands on deck today, as you very well know."
"Don't worry. I'll be back soon," Phoebe said, and hurried out.
Chapter 38. On the Way Back from Somerset. Ben pushed the underpowered bike to its limits as he rode back to Kent. He gripped the handlebars, staring straight ahead with a look of grim determination on his face. What if they chose to ignore him? How could he possibly make it to Biggin Hill before the Prime Minister arrived? And if he was there in time, what on earth could he do? At least it promised to be a beautiful day, sparkling clear. Lady Westrum would be happy for her garden party, he thought. Of course, he had to get Pamma home for that. Another thing to worry about. Pamma would undoubtedly be chastised for not being there to help her mother prepare, but surely they'd all see that this was more important. They passed Stonehenge, left Hampshire behind, then through the genteel gardens of Surrey, arriving at Biggin Hill around noon. The gate was closed, and a guard walked out to them as Ben removed his goggles.
"Sorry, the ceremony is already over," he said. "Is the Prime Minister here?"
Ben snapped out the words.
"Already left, mate," the guard said.
Ben heaved a sigh of relief.
"Is he going back to London?"
The guard grinned.
"He don't tell me his plans, son. But I heard he wanted to pop in and see his house, seeing it so close by."
Chartwell, of course. A stone's throw away, Ben thought. Should he go after the PM?
"What was this ceremony?"
Pamela asked, climbing out of the sidecar and stretching as she spoke.
"Remembering our chaps who went down at the Battle of Britain last year, and presenting a few gongs, that's all. Keeping up morale. There's one of our chaps just made it back to Blighty after escaping from a German prison camp. What a tale he had to tell. He was the only one who survived an attempted breakout. He was shot and played dead, but managed to get
all the way across Germany and France. The Prime Minister made a big fuss of him.
"We know him," Pamela exclaimed. "He's a good friend. Is he still here?"
The guard looked around. "He was just saying goodbye to his family last time I saw," he said. "Oh, there he is over there. Hold on, I'll get him for you. Oi, Gunner Davis, more friends to see you," he shouted. A small, wiry man came toward them. He looked confused when he saw Ben and Pamma.
"Yes, can I help you?"
he asked. "I'm sorry," Ben said. "Our mistake. We thought you'd be our friend, Flight Lieutenant Prescott. He also escaped a German prison camp recently."
"Prescott?" The man shook his head. "He's back in England?" "Well, strike me pink. We all thought he was a goner." "No. If it was the same prison camp, he survived the breakout by playing dead, just like you," Pamela said. "He was wounded, but he made his way back to England. He was awfully brave, as I'm sure you were." The man scratched his head, pushing his cap sideways. "That's not right, miss. Lieutenant Prescott was in the same camp, but he wasn't part of the breakout. He was taken away in a German staff car a couple of weeks before. Gestapo, I'm pretty sure. In fact, when the Jerrys were waiting for us in the woods as we came out of the tunnel, I thought to myself that they tortured Prescott and he'd spilled the beans. So he made it home, did he? I wonder how he managed that. We thought he was a goner." Ben looked at Pamela. Neither of them could find anything to say. "Thank you, Gunner Davis," Pamela said at last,
"and congratulations on your medal.
Well deserved."
Ben looked at her with admiration. No wonder people respected the upper classes. She'd just had a second devastating blow, but she remained calm, poised, gracious. Confused thoughts were buzzing around in his head. If Jeremy had been taken away from the camp by the Germans, how on earth had he made it home? Escaping from a prison camp was one thing. Escaping from the Gestapo was something else. And why had he lied about being part of the breakout? Swimming down the river? Ben glanced at Pamela. The only way he could have escaped from the Gestapo would have been if they'd let him go. Ben felt sick and cold inside. Jeremy had been his friend all his life. It was hard to believe that he'd turned traitor. There had to be a good explanation. He collected himself. He had a job to do.
"So the Prime Minister and all his entourage have left?"
The gate guard nodded.
"That's right."
"And they are going to Chartwell?" Ben asked.
"That was the original plan, so I heard, but Mr. Churchill called it off because he didn't think it was right to open up the house just for him."
Gunner Davis was still standing nearby.
"Just stopping by on their way home to some garden party, I heard. Mrs. Churchill told Winston they shouldn't dawdle, or the Westrams would be annoyed if they were late."
Pamela's face was ashen white as she climbed back into the sidecar.
"I can't believe it."
She turned away from Ben.
"I thought I knew him, but I didn't know him at all."
Then she started to say,
"You don't think that..."
But she couldn't finish the sentence. Phoebe and Alfie came out of the gate and headed toward the village.
"Who do you think they are going to shoot with that gun?" Alfie asked.
"Mr. Churchill, of course," Phoebe said. "He's coming here today for the garden party. We were right all along, Alfie. There must be a German spy in the neighbourhood. If only we could find out who it is."
"We can tell the grown-ups. Then it's up to them," Alfie said.
"But the garden party should be pretty safe. They can put guards on the gate. It's pretty bloody impossible to climb that wall."
"Your language still hasn't improved," Phoebe said primly.
Then she looked at him.
but I'm glad you're here with me. I wouldn't like to have to do this alone."
They stepped into the hedge and heard the sound of an approaching vehicle. It was a small white delivery van. It slowed to a halt.